I'm going to tell you a story first. When I was a rabbi in Miami, I once went to get a haircut on Miami Beach, which I usually did not do. I had a haircut in my neighborhood. And I sit down ready to tell the barber exactly what kind of haircut I want. And he says, no, I know exactly what you want. And at that point, he takes the clippers and shaves my head bald, right down the middle. Turns out that all the Satmar Hasidim who spend their winters in Miami Beach go to him as a barber, and he assumed, looking at me, that I must be one of them. So I had a bald spot, like a Last of the Mohicans, down the middle of my head. I had no other choice but to tell him to finish off the job. That was on a Friday. Shabbos, I went to shul with my hat on. And I got up to say my drasha, and I told them, look, I'm going to give you 5 minutes to get out of your system. I'm going to take off my hat. After that, I don't want to hear a word about it. So I took off my hat. And it was 5 minutes of laughter, and after that, that's not the reason I'm wearing a hat now. My yarmulke blew out of my car on the way here. And I thought I had a spare in the back of my car, but I need about a week to be able to find it. So I'm going to give the shiur with a hat on, but I don't want anybody to have any ideas of what's underneath the hat. It's my regular head, regular haircut. I just lost my yarmulke. Okay. And I will, after this shiur, go to Geula and buy a new one.
You're going to buy two of them.
Right. Good advice. That's probably what my wife would say. Well, she probably would say buy five of them. Okay, that's taken care of. Let's get on with the shiur. Okay, we were in the middle of discussing the directive of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola HaAmidu Talmidim Harbe. Last week we spoke about a few ideas of what it means, HaAmidu Talmidim Harbe. This week I want to explain a few more. Another idea of HaAmidu, what it means to put them, stand them up. So another idea is, since sheker ein lo raglayim, falsehood has no leg to stand on, which means that sheker really has no substance to it. It's just a dimyon. It's just a imaginary thing, because really sheker is falsehood, so it doesn't exist. And therefore the word sheker itself intimates that. The word sheker, the Gemara says, none of the letters of sheker stand on more than one leg. The shin comes to a point. That's how you're supposed to write a shin in the Torah. It comes to a point. It's not on a base. The kuf has one leg, and the resh has one leg. And the letters are bunched together, shin, kuf, resh, right next to each other in the aleph base and backwards, which all shows that sheker has no real substance, no real existence. It is an imaginary world, the world of sheker. It's a lie. It's false. Doesn't exist. Whereas MS, every letter of MS has a base. The aleph has two legs, the mem has a base, the tav has two legs. And they're spread over the entire aleph base. Aleph, mem, tav span the entire aleph base. That's where there's real substance. Now on the surface, that and then therefore it says Hamidu Talmidim Harbe, put them on their legs and teach them the truth, because sheker, falsehood, has no legs to it. So let your students stand on their legs, meaning teach them the truth. Now that seems a little difficult, that all the sheker in the world, all that which is false, really is not substantive. It really doesn't exist. First of all, we can see that in history, recurrent or recent history, going back to the Soviet Union. right? The sheker of the Soviet Union seemed to be very substantive, but overnight it dissipated like smoke, like we say in the davening on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. V'chol harisha kula ke'oshon tichle. All of the evil in the world will disappear like smoke. And that was hard to understand. How can all the evil is strong. How's it going to disappear like smoke? Just something that was a smoke screen. And just a little wind can push it away. So the Soviet Union overnight, without any shots fired. And today, Egypt, right, 30 years of Mubarak, seemed to be very, very strong, substantive, and overnight, no more. So the evil in this world, the sheker in this world, is really not substantive. But I really learned this lesson from something else. Way back when Disney World opened in Orlando. So I lived in Miami, and I took my children, my wife and children, to Disney World when it first opened. First Chol HaMoed Pesach that it was open, we went for a Chol HaMoed Tiul to Disney World. And I remember they had there, one of the attractions was the Hall of Presidents. The Hall of Presidents, there was all of the, not mannequins, just dolls that look like the president. They were robots that moved, that grimaced, that sweated. They were really real-life people. And I remember taking one of my sons into this Hall of Presidents, and the presidents got up and they spoke very, very lifelike. So my son, who was at the time 5 or 6 years old, looks up to me and he says, "Are those people real?" And I said, no, they're just a bunch of dummies. And that was the wrong thing to say. I got very not nice looks from a lot of the people. And I saw that my son was deep in thought because these really looked like real people. And I just told him that they weren't. He's thinking and thinking and thinking. And he looks at me and he says, "Tati, is this chair real?" The next question was, "Are you real?" If those people aren't real, I don't know what's real. And it hit me then that the Ribbono Shel Olam gave Walt Disney the talent to be able to create a world of imagination that looks real, in order that people should understand that the world of falsehood also looks real, but it's no more real than Disney World. That's, if you want an example of something that looks very, very lifelike and real, but it's not. So that's what Disney World is all about. And Mimela, the world that we live in and looks real also and powerful and substantive, the Ribbono Shel Olam tells us the world of Sheker is really a world of illusion. It's not really there. It just appears to be there. But Sheker, Ein Lo Raglayim, Sheker has no feet. So when you teach your students, put them on their feet. In other words, teach them the emes. That's another idea. Another idea of Hamidu Talmidim Harbe, that a Rebbe has to see to it that not only the spiritual needs of his students are taken care of, but also he has to put them on their feet, meaning make sure they're able to exist financially and physically also. Because if the student can't eat and he can't afford to buy a good pair of pants or to take care of all the other needs that he has, even the needs of perhaps finding a shidduch and getting married and being able to cope in this world socially properly, then you haven't taught him anything. Because you can fill his head with Torah, but if he can't access it and he can't use it in the real world, then you haven't taught him anything. So the responsibility of a school, a yeshiva, of a Rosh Hashiva, of a Rebbe, is more than just taking care of the intellectual needs of his students. They have to take care of the physical and material needs of the student also. And that, the Tosfos Yontif says, is what it means, Hamidu. Put them on their feet. Let them be able to exist in this world. Unfortunately, there are many institutions and many teachers who feel the opposite, that the students are there to make sure that the Rebbe is able to exist materially and financially, and the institution is able to get on its feet. Right? There are many institutions that won't accept students that may give the institution maybe a little, not such a good name, it takes weaker students or whatever, which we'll discuss in a little while anyway, and that the students, the tuition that they pay is more important than the student. And without tuition, they don't accept students unless they can pay the full amount or whatever. That's not what the Tosfos Yontif says. Tosfos Yontif says the responsibility is the other way. It's the school, the Rosh Yeshiva, the Rebbe, who's responsible to make sure that his student is able to exist, not the opposite way. So even though it's important that schools receive tuitions, and they can't exist and they can't pay salaries without it, but when that becomes the main thing, and that's more important than the student, then something's wrong. Okay, enough said about that. Let's go on to the next thing. Next idea. Hamidu Talmidim Harbe. Some say what it means is that even if a person has students when he's young, he should also have students when he's older. The Gemara learns that from the Pasuk. Baboker Zra Es Zarecha. In the morning, you should sow your seed, plant your field. V'la'erev Al Tanach Yodecha. But don't leave to the evening, do it again. Because you never know which crop will be more successful. The Gemara learns from that, that if a person had children when he was young, he should continue to have children when he's older. Because you never know which children will be more successful. Maybe when you're young, you make all the mistakes, and you raise those children the wrong way, and they end up being not so much of a nachas. When you get older, you learn from your mistakes, and you raise the other children in a nicer way. Or maybe the first children just didn't have it, and the second ones do. So you never know where you're going to see success from. Don't give up and continue having children. That's one thing the Gemara learns from that. Le'erev al tanach yodecha. It also learns that if you had students when you were younger, and maybe they were not so successful, don't stop having students and have students when you're older. Maybe they'll be successful. And then the Gemara brings the example of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, in his youth, had 24,000 students, 12,000 pairs of students. And we know what happened to them. They all died between Pesach and Shavuos, and that's why we have the mourning customs during the Omer, because of their death. So they didn't, the reason was, Shelo Nohagu Kavod Zeh B'Zeh. They didn't treat each other with the proper respect, okay, whatever that means. It's not for now, wait till after Pesach, we'll speak about it. But whatever it means, he wasn't 100% successful with those students. And they all died. And in the end, you know how many students Rabbi Akiva had? 5. And from those 5 students came the entire Mesorah, the entire tradition of Torah Shebaal Peh was continued through those 5 students. So he had 24,000 students, wasn't successful with them. 5 students, and those are the ones that really made the mark on history. So you can never tell. So if you had students when you're younger, Midim Talmidim Harbe, not a lot in number, but in time in life. Have it when you're younger, have it again, have the students when you're older also. Okay, now I want to go into the main thing that I want to discuss about this idea of Hamidu Talmidim Harbe. And that is that there are differences of opinion who's fit to be a student. Who do you bring into your yeshiva, into your Beis Medrash to teach? So Ram Gamliel said that you should only teach students who are tocham kibarim, whose inside and outside are equal. In other words, they're through and through good people, they have good midos, they have, they're the kind of students that are exemplary people, and therefore teach them. And the reason being, reveal hold like that, because if you teach somebody Torah, and they're not such an exemplary person, and then they go and represent Torah with all the knowledge that you taught them, and they're the kind of people that will make a Chilul Hashem, then it's better you didn't teach such a person. So that was Rabbi Gamliel's opinion. Beis Shammai also says you should only teach someone who has the mental capabilities of being a Chacham. He's mentally equipped to accept what you're going to teach him. He's a good student. And also, he's an Anav. He's humble. So he will have the right kind of character. Same idea. If you teach somebody who's not like that, first of all, you may be wasting your time because he's not capable of learning that much. And secondly, he may, if he's a haughty person and has bad midos, he may use the Torah in a negative way and make a Chilul Hashem. So therefore, they both hold, Beis Shammai and Rav Gamliel, that one should only teach exemplary people and bring them in to learn Torah. Okay. What do you do with the others? We'll discuss in a few minutes. But that's their opinion. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, when he became Rosh Yeshiva, had a different opinion. He let everybody come in and learn. And that's what it means. The Mishnah says, "Hamidu talmidim harbe," not like Rav Gamliel, and not like Beis Shammai, that you have to be very selective in who you teach, but teach everyone. Well, not everyone. We'll see that there is a limit, right? But don't be so selective, not in intelligence and not in character. Okay, what I said is a problem. Right, that maybe you'll teach somebody a Talmud she'eino hagum, and he'll end up making a Chilul Hashem. So that's part of the responsibility of the teacher. Not only to teach the child or the person that he's dealing with, sometimes not dealing with children, right? Not only to teach him knowledge, but to teach him how to be a mensch. That's also part of what Torah is. So in the hope that most Jewish children and even Jewish adults have the capacity of being taught and trained to be proper people. There are exceptions. But most, so therefore, accept them as students and make them into a mensch. And the ones that are not so intellectually inclined, teach them what they can understand. There is no Jewish child that can't learn some Torah. In fact, there's a Marsha. The Marsha explains the following Gemara. Kol hamoneya Torah mi talmid, a person who holds back Torah from a student, even the embryos curse him. So Marsha says, what do I do with embryos cursing the person who won't teach? He says, talking about a teacher who will not teach a student because he says that he's not capable of learning. He has a shvera kap, right? His IQ is not that high, and he's not from the more intelligent, and therefore it's a waste of time to teach it. And unfortunately, we live in a world where there are institutions like that. They only take in the brightest, and a student who has a B, C average definitely doesn't make it into the doors of that institution. There's something to say about that. If the institution really produces the leaders of Klal Yisrael, perhaps, but even with that, I don't agree with that. But in any case, so the Marsha says like this, somebody says, why would he not accept a student that has a shvera kap, that's not so intellectually inclined? Because he said that this guy is not capable of learning Torah. It's a waste of time. You know who learns Torah? An uber. Embryo learns Torah with malachim. Right? If an embryo can learn Torah, anybody can learn Torah. So, and not only that, but if every embryo learned Torah, that means that the guy that you think can't learn Torah already learned the whole thing. All you have to do is find a way of accessing it. It's all there. Every Jewish child has all the Torah within them from a malach. So who are you to say that that child is not capable of learning Torah? He may not be capable of learning Torah on the level of somebody else, but that just makes no difference. He's able to learn it on his level, what the malach gave to him. So therefore, somebody who says that there are children that are just not capable of learning, and therefore I'm not going to waste my time teaching them, then the embryos are going to curse them because it would imply that the malach shouldn't learn with them either. The So what do you do? How do you accept everybody? Right? What about students that are not Bali Midos Tovos, and they disrupt other children, and they influence other children for the bad? Do you accept them also into the school? So basically, the rule of thumb is the following, and that is a child who may not learn as well as the other children in the class. She's not adept intellectually. That's not a reason to put that child out, because the child will learn what he can learn, and schools should make the level of learning pretty much hit the average, so, and give incentive to the above average and give extra help to the below average. It's usually how things have to be. It costs a little bit more money. That's the responsibility of the school. A yeshiva, the same thing. A yeshiva should have various classes that fit the different intellectual levels of the students. So intellectual level is not a reason ever to dismiss a child, right, from a class. And even if he won't understand that much, he'll get what he can get. There's a story of a Malamed in Bnei Brak, years and years ago, the time of the Chazon Ish, who was known to be the most humble person that you could find. That was his main character trait. He was a very humble person, and he was a Malamed in Bnei Brak. One day the Chazon Ish called him in, and when he came into the door of the Chazon Ish's abode, the Chazon Ish looked up at him and yelled at him, "Balgaiva, you haughty person." The person, that's the last thing in the world anybody ever called him in his life. Haughty person. Told him, "Sit down." He said, "I understand that you dismissed a child. You threw a child out," in today's language, even though somebody once told me, "Garbage you throw out. Children you don't throw out." So that language depicts exactly what the philosophy of the school is, right? But in any case, you dismissed a child from your class, put him out of the class yesterday. I want you to know that dinei nefashos, capital cases, cases that deal with human life, to execute somebody or not, you need 23 qualified judges to judge those cases. Three judges that normally judge cases of monetary cases can't judge capital cases. Only 23 judges. You consider yourself in the place of 23 judges to make decisions that could affect a person's life. Life and death. Asking a child to leave a class is life and death. And you do that without consulting anybody else? Then you are the haughtiest person I know who thinks he's in the place of 23 qualified judges. To dismiss a child sometimes for narishkeit, and could affect that child for the rest of his life. For the rest of his life. You never, never tell. I'll tell you a story, even though it's a little embarrassing, but something happened to me recently. Mamish. After somebody, I'm not going to tell you the good part, I'll tell you the bad one. Somebody came to me, I spent Shabbos here in the Israel Center about 2 weeks ago. And somebody came to me and told me that he had just come to Eretz Yisrael, and consulted one of the Gedolim, and he told me he should get in touch with me and make contact with me. I felt very good. It's Adam Gogol told him to get in touch with me. So the Rabbanu Shem decided maybe I was feeling too good. So I went back to my hotel for Shalosh Shuvos. I was in a rush running up the stairs there, and a few minutes left till Shkia, and I come to a floor, and a guy looks at me and looks, and I saw that he's trying to identify. I said, "My name is Lev." He said, "I thought so." And he said, "I have something I'd like to ask you." I said, "Could you wait till come back before Marv? I'll come a few minutes early, but right now I'm rushing to Shalosh Shuvos. I really don't have time. But if you'll come to Marv, I'll come early." So I came early, and he was there. He said, "You remember me?" I looked at him. I said, "Not really." He said, 40 years ago, right, in Telzer Yeshiva, I was the dormitory counselor. And part of my job was to enforce the rules of the dormitory, which one of them was that the Bachur were not allowed to have radios. Radios. Those are those things with knobs that used to exist. The today they call them MP3 or iPods or whatever. But they used to have this thing called radios. And they didn't want these Bachrim to have the radios for various reasons. Most of what was on the radio was not in keeping with what they were learning, and they took their mind off the learning, and Bachrim were not allowed to have radios. And my job was to go around and to see if Bachrim were hiding radios and having them, you know, in the dormitory in a way that was not permitted. And believe me, Bachrim are extremely ingenious. I remember once walking into a room, and there was this big, thick dictionary on the shelf, and I really had a word that I really wanted to look up, and it was an opportunity, so I picked the dictionary off the shelf, opened it up, and it was cut out in the middle with a radio inside. So I left the radio there. I figured I can use this to my best advantage. I left the radio there. I walked into that room at night to see that the boys should go to sleep on time. And I said, I have this sense that there's a radio somewhere in this room. After being in this job for so long, the Rabban Hashem gave me a sixth sense to be able to, like, just feel if there's a radio around. And I said, it's coming from that direction. And I walked over to the dictionary, pulled it out, opened it up, took out the radio, and walked out of the room. That gave me fear in the, right? He has a sixth sense. He could tell where it is without even knowing. In any case, so Bachrim were very ingenious. So I must have found the radio in this guy's room, and I confiscated it and told the Rosh Yeshivas that what happened. Usually, if somebody had a radio, it wasn't all that serious. And he was reprimanded and told not to do it again, and the radio was taken away and given back when he went home, Ben Azman. That's usually what happened. Person said, do you remember 40 years ago you took away a radio from my room and told the Rosh Yeshivas that I had a radio and it wasn't even me, it was my roommate's radio, right? And you accused me. I said, okay, I'm sorry, right? But he said, you know, that Zman, they threw me out of the yeshiva. I said, it couldn't be because of the radio. He said, no, it was because of the radio, that they asked me not to come back, and because of that, it marred my life for the next 6 years that I was thrown out of a yeshiva, right? It really made my life miserable. I needed counseling. I needed therapy. Till finally I got married, and now, Baruch Hashem, I'm okay, but I never forgave you. And for years, every time I heard your name or saw it or whatever, right, I would say, that's the guy. The Baruch Hashem, I thought he was going to say, who knows what kind of curses he put on me. And so I told him, look, I don't remember the incident. My job was to do that. Usually it didn't end in such serious things. My heart tells me, I didn't tell him that there was a lot more than just the radio, and that's why he was asked to leave, but I don't remember one way or the other. And but it made such an impression on him, I figured after 40 years, it's kedai to ask him mechila. So I asked him mechila, and I told him, look, if you, after Shabbos, give me your address, I'll write you a letter of apology. Right? I truly didn't mean to affect your life the way that it did. Right? All I meant to do is do my job, and usually that was not something so serious that could cause such a... But look, 40 years. Because he was asked to leave a yeshiva, how it affected him. So the Chazon Ish told him, you are... thinks that you can make these decisions on your own in the place of 23 judges that need to judge what's it called, capital cases. You should realize that sending a child out of your class is a capital case. You're dealing with lives. You can't take that a responsibility on your shoulders alone. Hold on one second. That does not mean that there isn't a time to ask a child to leave a class. What is the rule of thumb usually, even though, like in everything in Torah, there are no rules, and even that's not a rule, says Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, but every situation has to be judged by itself. But the general rule is, if a child is not influencing others for the bad, and he's not totally disruptive and disrupting what other children are learning, then you don't ask a child like that, you don't dismiss him from the class. If a child is disruptive and he causes the other ones not to be able to learn, or he is a bad influence, then yes, there's a time to ask a child to leave a class. In 1 second, we'll see, though, what you do with him. So there is a time to dismiss a child or not accept a child into a school because of the nature of the child. Okay. So now what do you do with him? So most schools say, that's not my responsibility, right? I can't have this child in my school. He's disruptive and he's a bad influence. Or he's disruptive or he's a bad influence. So that's it, not my responsibility. You know what the Gemara says? The Rambam says, Yutaka, do not teach a child, a student, who is a Talmud She'eino Hogum. Not that he's not bright, not that he's not, you know, the most, the best midos, but he's really disruptive, and he's really a bad influence. That's a Talmud She'eino Hogum. So what do you do with him? You don't let him into the class, but you teach him how to be a mensch. So you create classes for children like this to teach them how to be a mensch. That's what you have to do. You can't be mafker the child. You can't abandon the child. You have a responsibility to teach every child. Except some children you teach in the normal classroom, and some children you have to teach first to be a mensch. But you can't abandon them. You know what's even worse than this? Tell teachers all the time. Sometimes it's too much trouble to throw a child out of the class or to expel him from the school. Too much trouble with the parents and too much trouble with the who knows what. So you know what a teacher does? They just ignore the child. They basically throw him out of the class, but he doesn't know it. The parents don't know it. Nobody knows it, right, except the teacher. That child they don't deal with. They just leave them there and ignore them. That's worse than throwing them out of the class. You throw them out of the class, at least they know they're thrown out of the class. The parents know. The principal knows. Somebody knows. Something could be done. But if you totally ignore a child and throw them out of the class, but don't throw them out of the class, then nobody knows. Nobody can do anything about it. And the child thinks that he's still in the class when the teacher is totally ignoring him. That's even worse. That's even a bigger din in the fascist. So, true, you sometimes can't teach students that are disruptive and a bad influence, but you can't be mafker them either. You have to find an environment where they can also, you don't give up on a child who's 10 years old, 11 years old, 12 years old, and that's it, for the rest of his life he's worthless. You work with him. So if you can't work with him within the normal class, then you find a place that has a different class. And that's why there are schools that deal with children that need to be taught how not to be disruptive and how to be have to have good midos before they're taught knowledge. Before they're imparted Torah knowledge, first they have to have how to live a Torah life. So, but you can't mimatker children like that. And unfortunately, many institutions feel that, you know, that if the child is not perfect, then I can't teach him. They don't understand the chinuch is trying to make people perfect, not dealing with perfect people. Because nobody's perfect. So if you're not going to accept anybody who is imperfect, then really shouldn't accept anybody, and the teacher shouldn't be there, nor the principal, because none of them are perfect. And sometimes some of the biggest successes in chinuch and the biggest credits to Klal Yisrael are students that were troublemakers when they were younger and needed to be put on the right path in the right way. And eventually, you saw the nachas. That's also Talmidim, Talmidim Harbe. Have a lot of students, because you never know where the hatzlacha is going to come from. And sometimes the student that appears to be worthless, he's not going to go anywhere. He's the least likely to succeed. But he's going to, from him, you're going to see the Hatzlacha. I remember in the yeshiva, usually people were judged completely on their mental prowess, right? How much they could learn intellectually. And the ones that couldn't were looked upon as like, you know, the psolis, the refuse of the yeshiva. And usually people said, what are they going to amount to? Remember one boy who was in my shir, who taka had a very shvira cup, right? He really could never get it 100%. And everybody looked down on him like he was nobody special. What's he going to amount to? He ended up being a multimillionaire, who supported, I don't know how many yeshivas and kollelim. Because of him, people were learning Torah. Right? It's a miracle that he wasn't turned off to yeshivas and whatever because of the way he was treated. But he wasn't. He was a good neshama. And he, and all the people that thought, you know, what's he going to amount to? He did more for Klal Yisrael than some of these other superstars, really, bright boys, who ended up being really nothing in life. So you never can tell. So each one has their abilities and capabilities, and if you give them the opportunity to reach their potential, who knows what will come for them. Never know. Never know. So Rabbi Akiva was no great shakes when he was till he was 40 years old. He wasn't. He said that if I a Talmud Chacham, I'd like to kill him. He was anti. And till he was 40, he was an Amharic. His wife saw the potential he had, and he himself understood the potential. He says he saw a erosion, a water eroding rock, and he said, if water can erode rock, then Torah can make an inroad in my heart. And he knew there was hope for himself. 40 years old, he went and started learning in first grade. And his wife stood behind him. And his father-in-law disowned her because of this idiot that she married. He turned out to be Rabbi Akiva. So the father-in-law changed his mind eventually. But in any case, so you never know. You never know who's going to be the Rabbi Akivas. So, again, the rule of thumb is you can't accept a child that's going to be disruptive and influence others badly. But you don't give up on him. You find the environment to work on him, right, whatever it may be, to make a mensch out of him, to try to correct his situation. But a child is not disruptive. He's not maybe the brightest child. Let him sit there. He'll get what he can get. Try to get to him, too. Not only that, but we'll see, okay, next week we'll speak a little bit more about the mila of having a lot of different children in a school. Not all of them are superstars, but sometimes the ones that are not make it a environment where the ones who can produce will produce even more because they have a social system that is conducive. But if they would be the only people in the class, maybe they wouldn't be so productive. It's because of the interaction between a lot of children. We'll start with that in the session next week and finish this subtopic off and finally finish the Mishnah, almost. Yeah?
There's a story in the name of Rav
Shach. Here's a woman who knows a lot about education. Okay, so listen carefully, yeah?
And they came to Rav Shach and wanted to throw out a child. And Rav Shach said, what kind of household does he come from? And he says, well, they really don't know. He says, well, whatever, whatever. And does he have a little spending money in his pocket? And he says, who knows? He said, but what's him? You don't know anything about this child, and you're ready to throw him out. You should be thrown out, but that's not how you handle a child.
Okay.
And I heard that story in the name of Rav Shach.
Okay. And I'm sure that your husband in Memphis didn't throw children out just like this. That I'm sure of. I know a lot of the products.
He had one he was going to throw out, and the father came and said, you can't throw him out, I don't care what he is, you can't throw him out, because, so he didn't. But he had another one who didn't have a father, or the father was in jail or something, and nobody came to fight for him. And to this day, he still feels that he didn't do right by that child.
He remembers one that he didn't do right by, it's a good sign. Okay, we'll continue this next week. It's too important just to leave it like this.
All right, I got a minute.